Okay, good. Welcome to those of you that have come on this lovely, sunny, hot evening, really. And it's the last one before we break up. So next time will be obviously September. I don't know when yet, but I'll keep you informed on that. So we're going to continue to look through bits and pieces from the Genesis account of mainly Jacob, a bit of Joseph probably later on. So a lot more lies, deceit, and trickery coming up. That's our theme for today. How interesting. So we're in chapter 30, really. I can remember that we had a look at all the children that were going to be born and to various wives and or handmaids. So we're picking it up in chapter 30, verse 25, with, as I say, another piece of trickery. If you're expecting that I'm going to be able to help you to understand with brilliant insights into how the mating of sheep actually works in this particular case, I'm afraid not. Hopefully someone else might be able to add something. But the main point of the story, I suppose, is not so much how the farmyard things work, but what's going on in the mind and heart of the various people. So from verse 25, chapter 30, just skim it through if you're not familiar with the story, but what Jacob is now saying to Laban is that I've done a lot for you, done a lot of work, and I ought to be rewarded in some way. There's a very interesting phrase in verse 27, which we need to check various translations of. What does it mean by I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you? That's a very strange sort of phrase for Laban to say. What do you think he might have done by way of divination? He's obviously recognized that Laban has been blessed because of Jacob being there. But what's he really saying when it comes to the divination bit? Got any translations or anything to help? Malcolm?
Mine just says, I have observed the signs that Adonai has blessed me on account of you.
Yeah, okay. So he's just recognized that the fact that he's got pretty wealthy out of it is in itself the sign. Okay, Mary?
Learned by experience is what it says, and
Oh,
mine.
okay. Yeah. So that sounds like it's a sort of tricky phrase to deal with, and some of those translations, that's a bit better. So he goes through. Someone else in into the waiting room. That's it. So he comes up with some kind of scheme to do with tending various bits of the flocks, speckled or spotted, dark coloured, and so on. And they will be my wages. Why do you think he's sort of choosing these? It basically says, don't give me anything. I will just take these. So what's going on there? What's in Jacob's mind when he says, well, let's just pick out the ones that are like this, and that'll do.
Is there less than perfect?
Yeah, I suppose these are the ones that normally you wouldn't want. And therefore he's sort of pretending at least to be modest and humble and just take those. But do you think he's perhaps already got a plan in mind that he can wangle this a bit more to his advantage? And of course he says in verse 33, my honesty will testify for me in the future. In other words, it's a clear and easy way of distinguishing between them. That one's mine, that one's yours, and so on. But I wonder if he really should be using the word honesty here, given what he's going to do. Mary?
Yeah, that's exactly what it says here. Jacob offered to take the least desirable of the animals, but those so easily identified that there could be no accusation of stealing.
Yeah, that's the point. It makes it very clear cut. But I think he's already got in mind what he could possibly do to make this work to his advantage. Malcolm? Malcolm, you're saying something? Muted?
In mine it says, and I will let my integrity rather than honesty.
Okay. not a lot different there, but the idea is that it makes it clear and so on. But what he is going to do in some way is make it work to his advantage. Just want to check something in verse 35. So in verse 34, agreed, said Laban, we'll do it exactly like you say. And then in verse 35 on, was that same day he? Who's the he in verse 35, do you think?
Laban.
Yeah. I suppose it has to be Laban, but for what reasons?
To stop them breeding.
No, well, why does that be Laban and not Jacob, the he?
Because Laban doesn't want to more spotted and striped ones to be produced.
Okay, but...
Well, Laban is the last person mentioned in the previous verse.
Yeah.
So when it's he yeah. It refers to that person.
Yeah, it's usually the last person. But also, looking ahead to verse 36, then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob. So that then sort of nails it down and confirms it. But also, he's going to place them in the care of his sons. So are we sure that that means they're going to be placed in the care of Laban's sons? Is that what he's going to do? Does that make sense? Because it ought to be consistent. If Laban is separating them at this point and he's placing them in the care of his sons, his own sons, Laban's sons.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we know about Laban's sons? Do we have any idea who they are? And
no.
We know that Jacob's got lots of sons. So I'm just wondering whether Laban placed them, but in the care of Jacob's sons. Would that make sense? I'm really not sure, to be honest, but I just find there's too many he's and that going on to really be clear what's going on. But anyway, the net result is obvious that they're separated at that point. And then they separate, three-day journey apart. That's quite some distance, some time to travel. And Jacob's looking after the rest of Laban's flocks. So does that mean then that the speckledy ones and all the rest of it are now still with Laban and his sons, but a long way away from Jacob and the rest of Laban's flocks? That's the only way I can really sort of read that, because obviously Jacob needs to do what he's going to do with nobody else around to spot what's going on. So that three-day journey is sort of working again to Jacob's advantage. Malcolm?
Do we have any idea of the age of Jacob's sons at this point?
Not easy, is it? Except that it's after Rachel gave birth to Joseph, and therefore all the other children have already happened. Some time, so there have been some growing up going on in the meantime, but no, I don't think I've got any particular thing. We do have a mention of Laban's sons in chapter 31. Not surprising, therefore, he has got some sons. So I think Laban is putting them in the care of his own sons. That's the only sensible way to read that. And then some shenanigans with the wood, the branches from these various trees. I suppose Jacob must have known something about them and their qualities, but I still don't understand how putting them in the watering troughs actually helps when they mate, that the strong ones come out in his way, unless anyone has got any tremendous insights into how sheep go about this sort of thing.
Well, it's obviously some sort of drug, isn't it, that comes from these field.
Yes, drug in the positive sense of doing something to make them stronger, plus also making them look. So, I mean, how do you go from them being non-streaky or speckly to them being streaky and speckly, because these are the rest of Laban's flocks, aren't they? These are the ones that have not been already set apart. So he's making sure that a lot more are born that by rights will then belong to him. And he's doing it by making sure that the stronger females have this doctored water in some way.
He must have been into genetics in a big way.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps it's one of those things where just by sort of experience and know-how, years and years, and suddenly realising, oh, I wonder why that's happened. And then you work out how you can make it happen or something. I don't know. Mary, what have we got?
I've got a wee note at the bottom here. Jacob was not practicing superstition. He was exercising faith, which he somehow associated with the rods. God, having designed the laws of genetics, intervened and honoured Jacob's faith.
Yeah, so you're saying there that Jacob didn't really know quite what he was doing. He just probably was doing it out of faith somehow.
Yeah.
But it's not though God told him to do it, does it? I mean, it just says he did it.
No.
Anyway, the net result in verse 43, in this way, the man, that must be Jacob, that's mentioned, grew, and it says in mine, exceedingly prosperous. The actual Hebrew is meod meod, which is very, very. It's a way of saying exceedingly so, just by doubling up the word very by way of emphasis. And you get that sort of phrase several times earlier in Genesis and even ahead into Exodus. It's a way of saying exceedingly numerous or exceedingly prosperous or whatever. You just say he was actually very, very. Have we got Pat now?
I just wondered, going back to your previous question, I just wondered if it was shearing the sheep time, would they have dipped them at the same time? You know.
Okay. Again, I don't know one way or the other. So I can't answer that. I don't know what, I mean, it's obviously mating time when he does all this to make sure that it works. But Malcolm, I think we've got next.
Yeah, there's no punctuation in Hebrew. So in order to emphasize something, they always say it twice.
Yeah, that's, you're coming back to the very, very bit. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Yeah, it's not surprising. I'm just pointing out that's when you see a word like exceedingly, it really is the doubling up of very, for emphasis and so on. Well, okay, let's move on. Because at this point, he's going to have to flee from Laban, because they've eventually sort of noticed what's happening. I love verse 2 of chapter 31. Jacob noticed that Laban's attitude towards him was not what it had been. Oh, really? Wonder why. And again in verse 5, when he's talking to his wives, he says, I see that your father's attitude towards me is not what it was before. Okay, well spotted and not surprising. But he's now going to have to sort this out with his wives. So he says to them, you know, we're going to have to flee now, I'm afraid. But he also adds in verse 7, your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. Really? Do we know about that? And I know he cheated him about, you know, working 7 years and then another 7 years and so on. But do you really think that, is that true? I mean, it could be, because Laban might have been a bit like that. But we don't have any details, I don't think, do we, about how he was cheated. Because if that's the case, if Laban had been diddling him with his wages all that number of times, it makes you wonder if, therefore, Jacob now was really getting his own back, getting what he thought was worth. He was worth. Mary?
It says here 10 was a round number equal to time after time.
Okay, so you don't have to count to 10, it just means a lot.
Yeah.
In which case, then, you know, there's cheating going on sort of both ways. And you've got to bear in mind, all behind this, the background that we saw last time, is that now Jacob has had a dream at Bethel where God has met with him, said, I am the Lord, the God of your father, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants. I will do all this for you. I will watch over you. I will bring you back, and so on and so on and so on. So all the time, you've got this in Jacob's mind that actually God has chosen him. God is going to work things out for him. It might be back to the whole problem of, well, let's give God a helping hand in all these different things. But he must be aware, as he says, God has not allowed him to harm me, and so on. I don't know if everything that Jacob is saying here is actually true, you know, because he says God has not allowed him to harm me. If he said the speckled ones will be the ways he said, so God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me. Perhaps he believes that that's what's happened. And then he goes, I'll come back to you in a minute, Mary, but just to keep going, in verse 10, he says, I had another dream. And it's on the basis of that dream that he's now saying look up and the angel has spoken to him and said, do all these things. So maybe that we're now learning more, or maybe Jacob is actually, putting stuff out there that isn't quite right. I don't know. Mary, did you want to say something still?
No.
Okay. So any thoughts on that little bit up to about verse 13, where Jacob is about to flee, and basically he's trying to justify it to his wives. He's sent for them. They've got to come and join him in the fields. And he's going to explain that they're basically going back to the land of your birth. That's clearly what God has said to him, he believes. And verse 13, leave this land now and go back to your native land. So what do we make then of Rachel and Leah's response from verse 14 onwards? When they're suddenly aware of this, when they're faced with this situation, what are they going to say and do from verse 14 onwards, Malcolm?
Well, before you get to that bit, verse 13 is interesting, where God brings up the fact that he'd anointed a standing stone at Beit El. What's that got to do with the story?
Well, I think it's just, Jacob looking back to where he met with God back in verse chapter 28, when he had his dream there. And he did actually, in verse 18 of that, it says that he took the stone, didn't he, that he'd been sleeping on, and set it up as a pillow and poured oil on top of it.
Verse 13 here says, I am the God of Beit El, where you anointed a standing stone.
Okay, so you mean, why is God announcing himself in that way? Is the God of Beit El? Is that what you mean? Okay, I suppose obviously he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and so on, but it's just, I'm the God that met you there, I suppose. So it's just reminding of the incident rather than designating God in any particular way, I imagine. So we've got his wives now, who have got to make a decision, basically. So what's going on in their head, and what sort of decision have they come to?
Well, verse 14 says that they realize that they no longer have any inheritance from Laban.
Yeah.
And also that Laban in 15 is considering them foreigners since he had sold them.
Right. Yeah. So thanks, Pat, and then Mary.
They're faced with a choice, whether to choose between their husband or their own family.
Yeah, and obviously make the choice of their husband. Yeah, Mary.
Maybe I just wondered if it was because they were leaving the land, their own land, and going to Jacob's land, that they would miss out on their own inheritance.
Yeah. But I think they've realised now. Sorry, carry on, Mary.
No, it's just their own portion of their inheritance.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think naturally enough, they've decided to go with their husband rather than their father. Mm. I think also they know now on which side their bread is buttered, and therefore they know they know where the wealth really lies now. And obviously they must believe what Jacob has told them about his experiences of God, particularly at Bethel. So, Karen, your hand went up and down again. Yeah. Karen?
I was just going to say exactly what you've just said, sir.
Oh, okay.
You beat me to it.
That's nice to know. Thank you. So anyway, he loads up all his wives and children together with all his livestock, and off they go back to the land of Canaan. Pat? You're muted, Pat. We still can't hear you. No, okay. If you can manage it sometime, just come back in again, okay? Anyway, before they set off, and while Laban is busy with his sheep, Rachel goes and does something. She does some stealing of her own here. She steals her father's household gods. Any idea? Why? Why does she think that's a good thing to, well, does she think it's a good thing to do? Why do you think she decides to steal them? And that means to obviously take them away with them. Good thing or bad thing, or what do we make of that generally? We'll go for Mary. You're also muted, Mary.
Would it be because if they had the gods with them, there would be no luck go to their own family? They would lose out on God's blessing if they were, because they didn't have these idols.
So basically, she wants to take them with them because she still somehow believes in them, some way.
Yeah. I think maybe it was a kind of superstition.
Yeah.
But If her own family didn't have these idols, they wouldn't be blessed.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm only guessing.
It just shows what a strange, still sort of mixed up situation we've got. We'll see this again a little bit later.
Yeah. That, in the one new man, it says that it's said to be an attempt by Rachel to put an end to Laban's idol worship.
Yeah, as though she's doing him a good turn.
Mm.
Interesting, yeah. We got Pat unmuted now.
It's just that the earlier question, what I was trying to say was, in verse 15 it says, not only has he sold us, this is Rachel speaking, but he has used up what was paid for us. So
yeah.
They had no inheritance left in the land. And...
Yeah, so they're feeling pretty let down. By him from that point of view, and therefore maybe stealing the father's gods is a bit of revenge rather than sort of helping him out. In other words, take what's most valuable to him rather than most use to us, you know, do the worst thing that he wouldn't want to happen, if you like. And then of course the verse 20, there's another bit of deception because he decides to run away without telling him. And although it says again the word deceived, which comes up a huge amount here, I gather that literally it is he stole the heart of Laban. I don't know if other translations bear that out, it's to do with stealing has a... well, actually, there's two stealings going on. There's Rachel's doing some stealing, which would be... well, it's a wide range of meanings, but in this case, she's literally taking something. But in verse 20, moreover... Jacob is doing some stealing in a more sort of idiomatic way by stealing his heart, for instance. Now, what does that really mean here? Does it mean that he's, well, it does mean he's deceiving him in that sense. But there's also...
doesn't say that at all in the one you meant. It said he stole away unaware to Laban.
Yeah, okay. That's another use of the word stealing, yeah. But if you know the Hebrew for heart, it relates to the word Laban. It is Lev or Leb. So there might be a play on words going on here a little bit. He's stealing away from Laban. He's removing himself from the Lev of Laban, you know, the heart of Laban or something. So there could be all sorts of extra little meanings attached to that. But basically, it is he's going away secretly and therefore deceiving him. Malcolm?
Well, verse 20 in the CJB says, and Yaakov outwitted Laban, the Arami, by not telling him of his intended flight.
Yeah, that's right. So he wants to get away as soon as possible, as quickly as possible, with as much as possible. And so off he flees. So here he is again, fleeing for the second time, because he's had to flee from his brother in the past, Esau, and now he's having to flee from Laban. And then after 3 days, Laban works out what's going on. And so they set off after him. And eventually meet up and have a bit of a debate about the whole thing. And then you also get, as part of the story, this other little deception when he's looking for his gods. And Jacob answers this time quite truthfully, because he doesn't know what Rachel has done. Okay, if you find anyone who's done this, you can put him to death. But he doesn't realize that it's Rachel that done that. And Rachel very cleverly manages to keep them hidden inside the camel's saddle. So presumably they weren't too big, these household gods. We don't know what they were like and how many there were, but they weren't obviously massive great things. But he couldn't find them. And again, he's deceived. And this gives basically Jacob a chance to then be angry with Laban and say, here, are you accusing me of something? And it hasn't actually happened. The rest of that story develops. And if I've understood it correctly throughout the rest of the chapter, they sort of, I'm just trying to check a particular verse to make sure that I'm understanding it. They make a pact at some point. They sort of part, well, more amicably than you might otherwise have thought. They make a covenant. That's why in verse 44, make a covenant or a pact between them. And we'll see what that's like in a minute. But as a result of all this dialogue that goes on with them, I think they both realized effectively, well, we can't go on just fighting and outwitting each other. We better try and draw a line under it. So, Mary, what do you say to this point?
It says in verse 29 that God came to Laban in a dream.
Oh, right.
Not to harm Jacob. Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.
Yeah, which verse is that again? Oh,
29.
Oh, yes, that's right. So, well, last night, the God of your
so yeah. He might have evil in his heart to Jacob, be evil toward Jacob, but God had come to him knowing what his heart was,
yes,
and warned not to do it, whatever.
Yeah, I suppose
it's verse 24, not 29.
Well, there is, but it in 29.
Yeah, it is there in 29 as well, but that's why I couldn't find the word dream, but it seems to be the same thing. Basically, you get the impression that God is still going to look after Jacob at all points, even in the sense of intervening here with Laban, who just says, the God of your father. In other words, he's not my God, as we'll see in a minute, but somehow he is able to hear from the God of Jacob, and therefore be influenced by this. I'll come back to that point, because eventually you notice in verse 53, you get, when this pact is made between them, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. Okay, so if you remember who Nahor was way back in the Abraham story and so on, these obviously, well, I reckon it is actually talking about effectively what would be thought of as sort of ancestral deities, except in Abraham's case, it really is, Yahweh and so on. But it's the usual sort of covenant between the respective gods of the two parties, which shows that they are not both sort of following the same God in that sense. So, Mary again.
Could I ask what you think? And it says here, and Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That phrase occurs twice in verse 42, first of all, before you get to the swearing bit, I think. So as part of the comment Jacob's making, it's the God of my father, the God of Abraham. And instead of saying, and the God of and the God of Isaac, it's this strange phrase, the fear of Isaac. And I don't know, I think this is the only place, together with verse 53, where God is effectively described as the fear of, which I assume like always with fear and fear of the Lord, it does mean, you know, awe, reverence and so on, not just absolute terror. But it is an unusual phrase, which I don't think we find outside of this chapter, unless anyone knows differently.
I just wondered what it meant.
I can only assume it means in the way that we normally think of, God is being described here as the way we think of as the fear of the Lord. Our God is an awesome God. Our God is a fearful thing. A fearful thing to fall into his hands, that sort of thing. So maybe that's got something to do with it. But it comes out as just out of the blue, really, here, doesn't it? Laban and associated members of his family, now effectively Jacob's family, kiss and make up by the next morning, and he trots off back home again. But back in verse 38, we learn that 20 years have gone by. I've been with you for 20 years. So 20 years has gone by since Jacob ran away from Esau, who you remember was pretty mad and swearing revenge all over the place for the theft of birthright and the blessing and so on. And now he's got to face up to that. So we've had him running away from Esau and Laban, and now he's reconciled with Laban. And now we come to a very important chapter when Jacob starts to prepare himself in order to meet his other big nemesis, if you like, what's gone wrong in the past here. 20 years has gone by. What's gonna happen? What will have happened in those 20 years? So this is the second time that God meets with him through angels, because he's on his way back. Just like angels met with Jacob when he was leaving in the first place. And now there's angels there as well to encourage him, I suppose. This is the camp of God, chapter 32, verse 1. So he named the place, and my footnote tells you that this strange word means two camps. Okay, so it says, this is the camp of God. And now he names the place two camps or pair of camps. I wonder why he's going to decide that although it's the camp of God, he's actually going to name it two camps. If you read ahead, there's a bit of a clue in verse 7.
He split the camp.
Yeah. In verse 7, he divided everything he'd got into two. It says two groups, but the footnote actually mentions the word camps again. He's got a plan B, basically, because he just doesn't quite know how this is going to go. But he gets news that Esau's on the way and he's got 400 men with him. And again, you know, how do you read that? Is it a big sort of welcoming party that's coming, or is it an army of people are going to harm him. And Jacob in verse 7 is in fear and distress. Now, tell me what you might think of those two. There's a thought that these are two different emotions affecting two different sides of it. He might be fearful because of what will happen to him, but he might equally be distressed of what he might have to do. Is he going to be killed or will he have to kill? Is he going to have to fight or respond in some way? So he's bothered in both directions as to what might happen to him or what might he have to do. This is typical Jewish thinking in their commentaries. When they come across things like two words, fear and distress, they want to make something out of each one, as opposed to put the two together and say he was just in a bad way. But anyway, it says great fear and distress. So this is going to be a big moment for him. After 20 years, he just doesn't really know what's going to happen. So he makes these plans and then he prays. He prays. Basically, I suppose, reminding God that God has promised him various things. And now at this big moment, I really need you to work on my behalf because of everything that you've actually said. And he spends the night. I think we're going to learn eventually it's called Peniel, because he's going to wrestle with God there. But he's getting ready to spend the night somewhere. It's the usual sort of thing before a big moment the next day, the night before. How easily do you rest? How easily do you settle? But we learn that he's selected a gift for his brother, Esau. And when you read through from verse 14, exactly what's in there, that's quite a sizable gift, if you think about it. It's an awful lot of goats. Why do you think of those particular numbers? Any thoughts on the numbers? I'm looking, for instance, at the goats, the female and the male. 200 and only 20 male. Does that make sense?
The females are much more valuable than the males because they provide milk and young.
Yes, it's certainly to do with the young. In other words, you'll get a lot more young goats, kids, if you've got that amount of female compared to that amount of male. Okay, it's apparently the best way to make sure that there is rapid growth amongst the flock. Okay, so it's partly chosen in order for the gift to expand quickly, shall we say. It must be a known thing in the farming community and the way it's done in the Middle East and so on. So you certainly wouldn't have an equal numbers, but if you put them in this sort of ratio, you're guaranteeing quite a prolific increase. And he keeps calling it a gift. We'll come back to that later where it's mentioned, I think. I don't know whether anybody else. In verse 13, it's a gift. In verse 18, it's a gift. Does anyone have a different word for it? Any thoughts at this point? Is it just a gift, as in?
Present, yeah.
Giving them? Okay. But verse 20 says, I will pacify him with these gifts. Any thoughts on the word pacify? Any other? Appease, yes. Any other thoughts on that? Because it actually would be a word that would be used to Malcolm.
Well, he's still remembering that he left his parents because Esau was threatening to kill him.
Yeah. Okay. So he's wanting, obviously, to pacify him, appease him. But it's just the nature of this particular word. Any thoughts, John? And then.
Yeah, my translation's got propitiate.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, one of those fascinating religious words that we all sort of go, yeah, okay. You all know what propitiation is, don't you? Okay, perhaps you do. Angie, and then Karen, and then, if not, I'll explain it, but go on.
I was just going to say it was a peace offering. Yeah. Just use the word peace offering.
Yeah. Karen, you had your hand up again.
I wondered if there was any relationship in the numbers to the amount of years.
Oh, I see.
Obviously, it's 20 years and 200.
Yeah.
So 10 for each year and then 10
yeah.
males so well, to, in relation to.
Yeah, as well as the ratio of 10 to 1 to make them expand rapidly. Maybe it's 1 for each year and 10 for each year, yeah. Yeah, the word propitiation here, it's the word that we all know. It is the religious word. It is. It comes from Kippur, or atonement. Okay, it is to appease, as in appeasing a god. It's actually kapra in this case, but it's the same root of atonement. And to pacify, and the way they thought about it, to you make your offering, your sacrifices, you are appeasing the gods and so on. And they're still called gifts. They're still called gifts and so on. So we're going to then find how many times the word face is going to keep cropping up in these verses. So we'll pick it up in a minute from verse 22, one or two things to say, but keep your eye open for the amount of times it talks about face. Malcolm?
It's interesting that, you know, you sent the goats and the sheep on separately.
Yeah.
And then he kept the camels and cows and donkeys and colts to have a gap between the two lots.
Yeah.
So the fact that it was going to be two gifts or two presents was
right.
More apparent.
Yeah, that's right. And also, like, oh, it keeps coming. It's like when you're opening your presents from the Christmas tree and suddenly you find, oh, there's another one here. After all, there's another one here. It makes the whole thing a little bit more sort of, well, there's two ways of looking at it. It makes the gift seem hugely bigger because you're spreading it out a little bit. But it's also delaying the actual moment when he meets, because they don't meet and then he offers the gifts. All the gifts are sent ahead as though he wants to sort of get him on side before they actually meet up. Pat?
I just wondered if he was thinking back to when Isaac was blessing Jacob, how he stole his blessing, but he didn't really.
Yeah, that will all come out as this meeting develops. You're right. And that's why I keep mentioning there's something in this word gift, I think. But anyway, in the meantime, Jacob has got to do some wrestling. And they cross the ford of the Jabbok, which actually is a very similar word or, you know, Hebrew consonants to Jacob. So it's Jacob at the Jabbok. You can obviously hear the similarities. And the word wrestle is avak. So he avaks at the Jabbok. There's lots of particular sort of wordplay sort of going on here. There's actually a reference to this in Hosea, because when you read it, as always, you say, well, I wonder who exactly he was wrestling with. Was he a man? Was he an angel? Was it the Lord in some way? But if you can quickly enough find in Hosea chapter 12 and verse 4. So in Hosea chapter 12, it starts off in verse 3 about in his womb he grasped his brother's heel. As a man, he struggled with God. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. So Hosea interprets it anyway as an angel, the one that God sent. And it's at this point that his name is changed. Okay, we know this is going to happen. We've been waiting for this moment almost. Jacob, who is going to be renamed Israel, meaning struggle or sense of conflict, because you've struggled with God and with men and overcome. So it's at this point that the big name change has actually happened. Mary?
It's interesting that he was asked what his name was, and he said Jacob.
Yeah.
So he was telling the truth there, but he was telling lies. His father, he called himself Esau.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah. Okay, in the past.
Yeah. I just think that's amazing that he's being asked what his name is, and he's having to say truthfully that his name is Jacob.
Yeah, because in the past, when his father said, "Who are you? What is your name?" Remember that now. He actually he wanted confirmation from Jacob's own mouth, and Jacob lied and said, "I'm Esau." I wonder if that's why the angel, whatever it is, actually asked that, because presumably the angel is absolutely sure who he is. It's not one of those questions for information. It's a question for admission, isn't it? For confession.
It's defined as he's changed from a dumb liar to being an
honest
man.
Yeah, and because his name, Jacob, actually means, well, I think we said it meant sort of heel grabber or someone who deceives in some way, he's actually owning up to his nature as much as his name here. Right. Love it to be changed. Have we got John or Rhodes coming in now?
Yeah, it's back to Hosea 12:4. It goes on.
Yeah.
I've got the angel capitalized, but in my version. Ooh. And then the next sentence, he found him at Bethel and he spoke with us there. Even, verse 5, even Jehovah or Yahweh, the God of hosts. Yahweh is his memorial. So it kind of goes on to explain that this is Jesus.
As with all these things, it's sort of left, it's a bit open, but it's left where you sort of interpret it a little bit. I must admit, I'm not too bad, I don't know why, but I'm not too big on the idea of Jesus making all these particular appearances beforehand. I know it's one way of interpreting it, but I tend to go for it being an angel rather than these theophanies, but I don't know why, I just never quite got my head around why that would actually be. I know there's one or two places where it seems a bit more important than a particular angel. But there's similar experiences to Moses had when he met with God in the burning bush, when Joshua met the man saying, Joshua said, I think, whose side are you on or something? And he was obviously the angel of the Lord, the commander, and so on. Mary?
Yeah, I had a teaching on the angel, the Malach Hashem, and the Malach Hashem is always Jesus.
Okay, but that won't be a Jewish teaching.
The gentleman that spoke about the Malach Hashem wasn't Jewish, no.
No, but my point is, it's only something that we later, now Jesus has come as Jesus, that we could actually look back and say, oh, I wonder if it was Jesus. Anybody reading it at the time wouldn't be thinking that this was, you know, a son of God coming as such, in that sense anyway. Karen and then Malcolm.
Well, I'm just looking at verse 30, that, you know, name the place, Peniel, face of God. For he said, I have seen God face to face. Yeah, you know, nobody's. Yeah. It's said that nobody has seen God and lived, so it had to be another incarnation of God.
Yes, God in a form, whatever it looked like, a man or an angel or whatever. It's like seeing God face to face, but it isn't quite the same. Exactly. I said we're going to meet to have the word face time and time again. I think even it's earlier when it says. To back in verse 17, he instructs the one in the lead, when my brother Esau meets you, whenever you come across me, like they met, there's always a sort of face and face sort of way of describing it in the sort of the language, the idioms that are being used. Malcolm?
Forgive me if I digress a little, but his name was changed to Israel, and the E-L is God. And Israel means he strove with God. But with all due respect to Rose, I have to laugh that nearly every American preacher I hear doesn't say Israel, they say Israel.
Israel, okay. I mean, I've learned to try and say it as three syllables, Israel, rather than Israel, as though it's only two. I think it meant to really spell it out, Israel. And then you get the L bit across. Is there anything worth pursuing in the fact that the S and the R is also part of the name of Sarah or Sarai? Is there any link there? The S and the R of the first bit of the root? I don't know, but it's just something in common there. Anyway, eventually, having had all the wrestling, and now that his name is Israel, this is fitting in now with the covenant to come, and the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and the God of Israel, and so on is coming. Jacob is now ready to meet Esau. And we're moving obviously now to verse 33, chapter 33. Let's see what happens there. Mary first, though.
Yeah, I've got a wee note in my Bible here about when Jacob struggled at Penuel. It then says the sun rose on him.
Yeah.
And when you go back to Genesis 28 at Bethel, it said that the sun had set.
Oh.
So the sun was setting when he was going out the land.
Yeah.
And then when he came back into the land, the sun was rising. It's just... I've got a wee note here about that. Somebody must have taught on that.
That's very interesting. Those little details, you're right, because they're sort of like the bookends of the whole story. That there is, from chapter 28 to 32, it is like one continual narrative with these details in it. And yes, it would make sense within the narrative that those little sort of linguistic markers are put in there. But obviously, yes, the sun rose above him. It's like it's a new day for him. It's a new dawn. It's a new life. It's new everything.
It's like new beginnings.
Yeah, it is. I mean, literally, the end of the night. So the sun is rising and it would arise above him. And so so there's a physical side of it. But I think it's trying to say a bit more as well. Sunshine and everything else go with it, but now the big meeting is coming up, and there's Esau with his 400 men. So he decides again to divide the children up and so on, and at this time he goes on ahead. Verse 3, he does something quite significant, a bit extraordinary really. What does he do in verse 3?
He's bowing seven times.
Why do you think seven? I know it's a nice number, I know it means, you know, completion and all the rest of it, but you know, that's a lot. You do it once and then you sort of do it again, and all the time Esau is sort of waiting for him to stop doing this. Seven times. I wonder if he gets a message from the seven. It was actually the way that a vassal king paid homage to his suzerain, as they call them, to his sovereign. It was a sign of how you paid homage to your master, your leader.
Yeah, it says here the typical Eastern response represents complete submission.
Yeah. Well, that's because of the number seven, yeah. But he's then acting out.
Seven.
He's then acting out the way that any vassal king, if you like, someone who's got a lot, someone who is already, you know, in some position, but shows his submission to someone in greater authority, and that's what he does. But verse 4 is the real shock. What does verse 4 remind you of, and why is it a shock?
The prodigal son.
It definitely reminds you of the prodigal son. And do you remember what was shocking about that bit of the prodigal son story?
Well, his father killed the fatted calf, but and then his brother was jealous. Yeah.
But even before then, there's lots of things in the story that you wouldn't normally expect. We've got a hand up, John and Angie, though your picture's gone.
Sorry. The fact that the father ran to him, because in Middle East, no self-respecting older man would run anywhere.
Yes, running was not the thing you normally did. Is that what John and Rose were going to say? Or it is, okay. Yeah, I mean, in this case, it's not the father running, it's a brother running, but it's the fact that it's running is significant. It meets me and embraced him. I've got a feeling that it probably says in the original tonight, and he fell on his neck. That was the way that they used to express this. It sounds pretty awful and painful. And he threw his arms around him and he kissed him and they wept and so on. Now, I don't know how far apart they are when all this bowing goes on, but obviously there's some distance because presumably Esau at that point has stopped while this, you know, bowing is going on. And then his response to that is to run, not just to open his arms, not just to walk up, not just hold out his hand or anything like that. He actually responds. And you don't do that if you haven't already worked out in advance what you're going to do in this situation. There's no hesitation. There's no sense of he stopped and worked it out. He was already prepared to meet Jacob in this way. That's the impression I'm getting on this anyway. John and Rose again.
For verse 3, the translation, he prostrated himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother.
Yeah.
Oh, so you mean bowed down, walked a pace or two, bowed down a bit more?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that would work nicely. But there still must be enough distance between in order to for there to be some running anyway, even if the gap has been closed. Malcolm?
So one wonders how much Asab's attitude was changed by the huge presence that he'd just been given.
Yeah, yeah. It might have made him wonder. 20 years has gone by. It's interesting, isn't it? I haven't really got any similar experiences to recount here, but you've been estranged from someone and at odds with someone for that period of time, and then suddenly it all gets reconciled. We're not going to be doing this today, obviously, but you know how later on when Joseph is reconciled to his brothers after all that time, and suddenly they realise who he is and everything that's happened, there's a similar sort of family reunion sort of thing.
Esau gave him the gift, didn't he? He didn't accept it. He said, I've got enough.
Yeah, coming to that in a minute. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute, yeah. Maureen?
I was just going to say it's his older brother and he recognised.
Yeah. Yeah.
His older brother.
But he's got a bit of catching up to do because he wants to know who's all these people then. who's these women, who's all these children and so on. And they all come and do their bowing down bit and so on. Suddenly Esau realises that, oh, wow, a great deal has happened here. So, yeah, to come to the bit you just mentioned, and also let's just say that there's lots more faces going on here, hidden in the Hebrew words at some point. So in verse 10, if I found favour in your eyes, it's that sort of idea again. Accept this gift from me. Minkach, accept this gift. Please accept the present, this is verse 11, the present that was brought to you. Now, is there a difference there between this gift and this present? Does anyone have anything different in their translations between verse 10 and particularly verse 11? Because they're not the same word that's just been translated.
Blessing.
Yeah. Yeah, you got blessing as well. So it is berkat or berkati or something, as opposed to mincha. So he's actually using the word blessing here. Isn't that significant when the whole problem was about blessing in the first place? Mm. He's now wanting basically to return not just a gift, but a blessing because God has been gracious to me. And so on. And so you've already picked up. Esau said, verse 9, I already have plenty. And Jacob is going to say in verse 11, I have all I need. So Esau says, I already have plenty. And Jacob says, no, take it anyway. I have all I need. They're very similar in Hebrew. I have plenty, yesh li rav. But Jacob says, yesh li kol. And kol, I think, means everything, doesn't it? It means all. And it's like, I don't think he's boasting and sort of trying to outdo him, but there's a difference between having plenty and having absolutely everything.
Yeah, it says enough in mine.
For which one, though?
Verse 11.
Well, because I have enough.
Yeah.
Okay, but behind this is the idea, if you like, plenty is a large amount, but the enough or the what I've got here, the all I need is meant to be even more. Not just that I've got a lot, but I've got way, way more than I could possibly need. I've got an oversufficiency of everything. And okay, I don't know whether I don't think he's trying to boast or have a bit of one-upmanship going on here, but it's perhaps just a nice way of saying, I'll share it all with you anyway. So, John and Rose?
Yeah, I have everything, and then in italics, I need. So that kind of combines the two things together, as it were.
Yeah, but of course, there's a difference between saying I've got everything and I've got everything I need. Because to be honest, most of us, I can say I've got everything I need. But to be able to say I've got everything is a bit more, isn't it? So if it's in italics, it usually means that it's not actually part of the original. And the phrase yesh li kol will just end with I have I have it a lot, not just everything I need, but there's a bit more to it. Karen and then Pat.
I have more than enough.
Yeah, okay, that'd be a way of putting it, because almost like if you're saying you've got more than enough, well, what is more? Well, it keeps on being more. There's no limit almost, is there? Pat?
Wasn't the original blessing for Esau prosperity?
I'll have to look back at that. So when you say the original, so this is the one that he eventually got when he realised that that Jacob had got the other one. Which chapter was that? This is chapter 27 and verse 39. So you're talking about Esau, you're talking about Jacob, because
Esau.
Yeah, Esau, Isaac answered him and says, your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven. You'll live by the sword. You'll serve your brother. You'll grow restless. You'll throw his yoke from off your neck. That was Isaac's blessing to Esau then. But of course, originally, the blessing that was given erroneously to Jacob was about abundance of grain, new wine, and so on. But later on, the blessing became one of you will have children and the land and so on. But, you know,
he told him to save his brother. That was part of the blessing that Isaac gave him. It says, and you shall serve your brother.
Yeah.
So this is when he's getting all these gifts.
I mean, again, the point is at the end of it, they've both done rather well, if you like. And the most important thing, of course, at the end is that they are reconciled. That this sort of chapter in the story is closed.
I don't know if it is.
Well, go on then.
Because Esau wanted to accompany him and Jacob didn't, and then he said he would meet him. and at Mount Seir, and he had no intentions of going to Mount Seir to meet him.
Oh, okay, so you mean, yeah. I didn't mean that they were going to live happily ever after together again, but somehow they had put aside their differences from the past, I guess. Malcolm?
So I just noticed at the end of Genesis 34:11, talking about the gifts of blessings, thus he urged him until he accepted it. So Esau accepted the gift.
Yeah, that's chapter 33, verse 11, of course. Yeah. Yeah, he did have to insist. Well, John?
Well, they didn't tear each other to pieces. And they didn't even have a bout of fisticuffs or anything, actually things went rather well by comparison with what might have happened.
Indeed. And whether, as we said, all those animals and gifts and that had really helped, or whether Esau had already had a change of heart, and we don't know what had happened to him in the meantime, really, do we? The story's been focusing, obviously, on Jacob for various reasons. And we really come to the end of the story, because it's going to move on to for the rest of the book. But a little bit chapter 35. I don't know where, lots of people have disappeared all of a sudden. Can you still there? Mary, can you speak?
Yeah, I can speak. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think the internet went a bit wobbly.
Hang on. I think that was me. Were you all okay still?
Yeah. Your voice.
I think that was my. I've just got the message, usual thing about being unstable, but a lot of your screens went blank and I didn't quite know what was going on. I think we're back to normal then.
Yeah.
Mary, sorry, go on.
I just wanted to point out before we go on to something else that, remember, Rebecca, when she was putting all these ideas in Jacob's head to dupe his father. And she said, and he said to her, "Well, let the curse be on me," you know, she said. And interestingly enough, by the time Jacob got back into the land, she had already died. So she never saw her son again.
Yeah. Thank you.
Something to bring up before we move on.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really moving on. I'm just bringing things to a conclusion because the time's nearly up. I think that's what, is that what comes out in chapter 35 anyway, where we learn about Deborah, Rebecca's nurse dying there. But the point is,
it's Rebecca that died
before he got back. Yeah, but there's no mention of her either, is there?
There must be somewhere where we'll learn Rebecca has died. There's a bit much later on at the death of Isaac, and you can see that Rebecca's not there at that point.
Yeah, I mean she's conspicuous by her absence, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just that she did put a curse on herself.
Yeah, I know. But I don't think we know when she died, though, do we? That's what I'm saying. I can't find an actual verse, just that she's no longer there. So, interesting enough, in chapter 35 and verse 8, it talks about Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, dying, as though somehow we need to know about that. But the only other thing really is to say, ultimately, about Jacob, as obviously the story then moves on to his sons, and in particular Joseph, is that Jacob obviously comes back into play towards the end of of Genesis, because he is deceived himself by being told that Joseph is dead. So Jacob has, I think, made a bit of a mistake, really, by obviously over-favouring one of his sons. Probably never a great idea, setting him apart. And in chapter 37, you've got this famous coat of many colours, which may indeed not be many coloured at all. Richly ornamented is one version of it, but the phrase is actually unclear, not quite sure how to translate it. The Ketonet Pasim. It's almost like it's a special tunic. It might be multicoloured, but it's probably one that just sets someone apart as being higher up in someone's estimation. John, Rose?
Yeah, in relation to that, my version, well, I can't find it quite now, but it says, because I noted it before, it says down to his feet.
Yeah.
Now, this mirrors the same robe of Jesus in Revelation.
Okay.
And also, quite possibly, the robe that he had, the one piece that was they diced over, they gambled over at the cross.
Yeah, okay.
So it says it's important.
And I've also heard it talk about as being long-sleeved. The whole point of this, whether it's ornamented, long in length, long-sleeved, whatever, is not a working garment. It's something you give to someone who you think is going to be more in charge, a boss, rather than someone who's got to have to, you know, roll his sleeves up and so on. So I think the point is, this is chapter 37, if you want to put something like this. I have a feeling that, I don't know if he actually said it as such, but he actually gave all his sons a robe, but he gave Joseph another one. I don't know whether I've made that up or just misremembered it somehow, but it's not as though the others didn't have robes. It's just that Joseph was given this extra one, which basically made them think that he was going to at least order them about a little bit. What it begins in chapter 37 is that Joseph is a young man of 17. So at a very early age, he's been set apart in a way that probably he couldn't really cope with very much. I mean, he's going around wearing his father's favouritism for everyone to see, which probably wasn't the best move. Lisa, are you there?
Hello.
Hello,
yes. Yeah. I can't find it exactly now, but I remember reading that the coat that he was given was one of nobility, which royals would wear. That's what I read. I can't remember where.
Yeah.
Maybe British Bible.
I mean, I've got something like that. I've got here being worn by a princess in some cultures, but it was that kind of setting someone apart. It was haute couture, I think you say, if you're into that sort of thing. It wasn't just pretty. You know, it just had lots of nice colours on it. So, John again.
It was what we'd call a status symbol.
Yeah, yeah. John. Yeah.
Okay, I found a ref. Yes, I made him a tunic, and then italics reaching down. Reaching to the, and then soles, not italicized, of his feet. So it's a tunic to the soles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly the whole idea of it being many colors is a bit of a, well, not say mistranslation, but it's a bit of a liberty taken by certain translations. But it probably by implication, it would also be richly ornamented because of these other features. It also, but apparently the phrase, the Ketonet Pasim, is tricky to get exactly out of it. But the point is, he was wearing his father's favouritism, and that really doesn't go down well with everybody else. Jackie, then Malcolm?
I was just going to say that I don't know if it's in my translation, but I have definitely heard that it was a coat of many pieces.
Pieces, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe that as well. Yeah. Okay. Malcolm?
Nothing to do with a coat. 37 verse 2 says when Joseph was 17 years old, and then it goes on and says, though he was still a boy at 17.
Yeah. In fact, it's a bit of a strange phrase. This idea, he was tending the flocks with his brothers, doesn't necessarily mean he was doing it with them as a group of, was it five people? Many are together. No, more than five. They were not doing it together. He was there, probably as the sort of the young guy who was just sort of, I don't know, learning the trade or something. But he was already being set apart in lots of different ways. So it's almost like he was a young man of 17, tending the flocks with them. Didn't really feel as though he was part of them. He was almost like the odd job boy, the whole thing. But if you want to follow this through, the story of Joseph is one of, what we call them, cloaks, tunics, garments, that are on and off all the time. Because if you remember, I think the next time we read about his garment, it's being left in the hand of Potiphar's wife. I think that's right, isn't it? He slips out of it and runs away, left his cloak in her hand. But later on, he's going to be dressed again by Pharaoh and given the royal robe or appropriate to his position in the land. So people, if you want to make a little story out of the whole thing, it's looking at everything. Of course, he loses the garment. That's right. He loses the garment when his brothers decide to kill him because they take it from him, don't they, and dip it in blood to show the father, oh, look, he's died. He's been torn apart by an animal. And that was the whole point of mentioning this, really, because Jacob, again, is caught up in deception. So his robe is used in deception like that. Eventually, obviously, gets another robe when he's in the service of Potiphar. And that gets taken off him for another reason. And then he gets another one later on when he's serving Pharaoh. Mary? You're muted there, Mary. Mary.
Yeah. This is about many, many moons later when the girl that was raped by her brother, one of David's children, and it says, now she had on a robe of many colours, for the king's virgin's daughters wore such apparel. You know it. So that was the kind of apparel that was worn by the king's virgin daughters. But not that's getting to do with it. But I've only read twice about the coat of many colours. And that was Joseph's coat and this girl's coat.
Yeah. One of the ways that phrase is used, it's to do with virgin princesses as well, which again would go widely right down to the floor. That's what I think, but...
It's probably nothing to do with anything.
Only in that all these little phases are very interesting in their own right. But I suppose to wrap up the Jacob thing, he gets deceived again over Joseph, and there's a big reconciliation at the end. And so Jacob's life is full of ups and downs of that kind. And eventually he goes to Egypt. And of course, then he blesses all his sons in chapter 49. So there's obviously a lot more in all that. But we've had our time and looked at the main passages that we wanted to. So thanks again for all your contributions and thoughts. So should we switch off the recording at this point then? Thank you.